Hey, Jonathan Goodman here. I have super exciting news. My book, The Obvious Choice, that I've been talking about forever, is almost here. This is published by HarperCollins. The president of Shopify endorsed it. The editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine endorsed it. This thing is going to blow the roofs off, and I'm asking that you please pre-order your copy today on your local Amazon, wherever you buy books. It's available. It's called The Obvious Choice. Hope you pre-order it. Hope you love it.
I think whatever you're doing needs to be the most important thing that you're doing right then, and you should do the hell out of it. But I think you also, once that's done, I think you also can't sit there and bitch and moan if it perhaps doesn't get the response that you hope that it would get in the market.
Hey, and welcome back to the Obvious Choice podcast. I wrote something this weekend that I want to share with you, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get through the whole thing. We will try. This will probably be a pretty short episode, but anyway, here goes. It's called A Half Empty Cup. So there's a positive pregnancy test sitting on my desk. Pregnancy is something I've gotten used to. By this point, my wife and I have had 2 boys and 10 pregnancies, 8 miscarriages that we know about. We both want a big family, as big as possible, but she's 40 and I'm 38. We had both decided to keep the goalie pulled, but not get our hopes up. Allison told me later that day that it feels different this time. She's in tune with her body. I guess that happens after so much loss and emotion and fluctuating hormones. Then she felt ill. Like really ill. Ill to the point of not being able to stand up for more than 5 minutes without throwing up ill. On September 23rd, 2024, I sent my editor, whose name is Tim, I sent Tim an email with the subject, too early potential extension. So here's what that email said. It said, writing is going well, but my wife is extremely sick right now. She's effectively been in bed for 3 days straight. If she stands for more than 5 to 10 minutes, she needs to throw up. It's nothing to worry about. She's pregnant, but it's quite early. We aren't telling anybody. What this also means is that there's a good chance that it'll be like this for a while, weeks or even months. I'm only telling you this because I want to ask well in advance for a potential extension for the too early manuscript delivery. There's actually a few through lines with too early, depending on how things play out here, that might be a powerful story to tell, maybe in the epilogue or as an interlude. Themes of resiliency, for example. If my cup was full, this would have tipped me over. Now it's a challenge, nothing more. Themes of family and community. A decision to live close to my parents and investments into relationships with neighbors has led to a lot of support. Themes of physical resiliency. Years of showing up to the gym on days I didn't feel like it banked me a lot of fitness in reserve. The email ended like this. It said, I've no idea what's going to happen or how this will pan out, but I'll take notes and try to make reflections ongoing. Then when this period passes, I'll write it up and maybe we can add it into the book somehow. I picked up this again on October 25th, on my birthday, a month later. Some days are better than others. So this is me writing in real time on these days, right? Some days are better than others, but she's been more or less bedridden for 4 weeks and counting. Looking at a screen makes her sick, so does reading. And eating. If she does something crazy like go for a short walk, she'll have to lie down when she gets home. She can't read to her boys. Instead, she opens a book so that they can see the pictures and makes up a story. Perhaps the hardest part is that there's no defined end in sight. She's 10.5 weeks pregnant. We're hoping that the start of the second trimester will mark the end of her nausea. There's no way to know. One day she might just feel better, or maybe it'll be this way the entire pregnancy. 6 more months. We've no other option than to take it day by day. The question is not whether or not you will roll your ankle. It is whether or not rolling your ankle will injure you. Awful things happen. Loved ones get sick. Business deals go sour. Strings of bad luck feel endless. There's a lot of talk about resiliency these days, about fortitude and strength, and about gaining the skills to navigate the unknown, and all of that is great, but it's just as important to expect the unexpected, because the only thing that you can expect to happen with any degree of certainty is that at one point the unexpected will come and kick you in the ass. These few months were going to be busy regardless. In addition to writing the next book, I'm deep into the marketing of my previous book, The Obvious Choice. keeping up with daily content on social media, and operating my two companies. By my count, that's four jobs I was already doing. With Allison ill, I've added on caring for her, making meals, keeping the house tidy, and school pickups. This wonderful, miraculous, incredible, indescribable moment in time where we anxiously await our third child, a child we both resigned to never having after so much heartbreak, could have otherwise been a terribly stressful affair. On paper, the last month has been the busiest and the most difficult of my life. And yet I feel at ease. I've got a friend who works a busy job. So does his wife. Both make a lot of money, have a lot of professional responsibility. They also have two kids, a few years older than ours. Both do extracurricular math tutoring and hockey many times a week. A full-time nanny helps around their house. And their kids are orderly. They don't question their parents. They do as they're told. My kids, well, my oldest at least, Calvin, is like me. He's disagreeable. Rules to him and me are considered mere suggestions. He doesn't fall into line just because some authority said that it's how things are done here. Allison asked me my opinion on the difference between how we're raising our kids and our friends. And I honestly don't know which is better. Enforcing rules with an iron fist so that kids obey, or empowering children to talk back, find the way, screw up, break the rules, frustrate the hell out of their parents in order to find their way in a world where very little is black and white. I really don't know which is better. What I said to Allison was that our friends don't have a choice, though. Their cups are full. No room for anything unexpected. Of course their kids have to obey the rules and the rituals of the household. There is no other way that their household can operate. Which is fine. Until it isn't. You never know what you need until you need it. By then, it's very often too late, I said to Allison. Now, admittedly, we have an ideal situation for navigating Allison's illness. Our family support's amazing. My parents live around the corner. Mom comes over almost every day to help with the kids. And we love our neighbors. Last night, for example, Calvin and Jaden had dinner at one of their houses while I cleaned our place, helped Allison, and prepped for the week. And my work, of course, is very flexible. Some would say that we're lucky, and we are. But it's not just luck. It only seems like it. The quality of your life is downstream of the decisions that you make. Decisions made long ago, decisions made without fully knowing whether they'll pay off, how they'll pay off, and if they do, in what capacity. Decisions whose ramifications are only possible to appreciate in retrospect, or, most often, attributed to luck and fortune. Years back, I decided not to move to New York City to fast-track my career. I traded opportunity for professional flexibility. Allison and I could live anywhere in the world. Hawaii, Thailand, Panama. Pick your paradise, man. Enjoy year-round wealth. Get richer in tax havens. You name it. Instead, we bought a home in a place with high taxes, where it's cold half of the year, that just so happens to be, of course, a 6-minute and 49-second walk from my parents. We don't enroll Calvin in math tutoring after school. Maybe he won't get into as good of a college. But because he isn't overloaded with after-school extracurriculars, the little dude runs around the neighborhood knocking on doors, asking friends to play, becoming comfortable around their families. We didn't expect Allison to get pregnant. Well, that's not quite true. We expected her to get pregnant. You knew what we were doing, you know what I'm saying, right? We didn't expect her to stay pregnant. And we definitely did not expect her to get as ill as she got. We also didn't expect one of our dearest friends, a close neighbor, to get diagnosed with an aggressive form of breast cancer 2 weeks ago. A house cleaner with two young children, two young daughters, and with no benefits, who now can't work for the foreseeable future. It's Monday, the 28th of October now, her first chemotherapy session. For 2 days after each treatment, she'll be sweating out the chemicals and was told that she shouldn't be around her kids. We love our friends' kids. They might sleep over at our place tonight. We don't know yet. I'll pick them up after school and they'll have dinner at our place either way. Real life happens. You can prepare yourself to go along for the ride, or you can get hit by the car as it passes by. Building resiliency is about getting strong when times are good so you can stand tall when they're not. Don't fill your cup. Not because you can't, but because there's going to be something that will happen to you or to somebody that you love. And when it does, you're going to be happy that you've left space. How to Build Resiliency to Manage Hardship, the article titles read. They promote reactive care solutions like yoga or guided meditation, prayer, all useful things. But there's too much emphasis on reaction, not enough on prevention and preparedness. People talk about work-life balance. I've never liked that. Balance is binary, too precarious. If you're in balance, it means that you can also be in imbalance. I prefer the term work-life harmony. A flowing state where you can roll with the punches. Expect the unexpected. Become tolerant to life's intolerances. The best way to deal with something unhealthy is to first become as healthy as possible. Make decisions today that your future self will thank you for when shit hits the fan. Because it will. It's likely that you will notice others who have decided to fill their cups to the brim, win professional accolades, make more money, or even have better behaved children. You might question your life's decisions to leave your cup half empty. Until one day, your wife gets pregnant and becomes bedridden ill. And then your neighbor gets cancer. And you're somehow not stressed and miserable, instead challenged, grateful that you're able to enjoy the miracle of a pregnancy you never thought would happen. Grateful to be able to help a friend in need. On October 31st, Allison made it to her second trimester. She's not great, but she is feeling better. The next day, she went to get an imaging ultrasound, and she sent me this text message the day after. It said, "We could hardly see the heartbeat. Baby wouldn't stop moving." And then she had a little heart emoji. So that's why, this morning, 6 a.m., on Saturday, November 2nd, I'm sitting in my cold office crying. Finally letting myself feel all of the emotions that I've been holding in for the past month and a half while I was trying to be strong for my family, for my boys, and mostly for Allison, who just taught me what being strong really means. Writing up our story, grateful that our cup was half empty because we just needed every damn ounce of that space. And now there's going to be bunk beds.
I love that in reference to a touching story about conceiving your wife, you managed to slip in the sports reference, "We pulled the goalie." Very classy. Expect nothing other than that from John. It's like, did he say we pulled the goalie?
Wait, I need clarification. What's
your choice of goalie? Is your goalie Ren. Rubber? Is your goalie an injection? I'm sorry, go ahead.
The end.
Yes, Amber, what's your question? I'd like to go in that direction.
Yes. So you said bunk beds. So that means there's two babies. Is that what that means?
No. No, okay. There's one.
Okay.
There's one. She thought that there might have been, I mean, we have no history of twins in our family.
Yeah, but
She thought that just as a, like, just because of just how sick she's been.
Yeah.
She thought that it might have been twins, but there's one child in there. Like, we've seen the image.
It was moving so fast. No, maybe no they were twins. Just tangled up and shit. Yeah. Wouldn't be the first time.
As far as we know, there's only one. The image is very clear. She's done a... Oh, okay. Yeah, anyway. The image is very clear. We don't know the gender. We're not going to find out the gender until the baby's born. You know, it's one of the... It's like the last great mystery that you can maintain in life is, like, not knowing the gender until the baby is born, right?
Yeah.
And it is the last... It's the last romantic choice of long-term relationships, right? It's the last artistic fate to the winds.
Right.
Let's go old school. Because you know every single thing.
You know everything else.
Every second of the day. The mystery. By the way, even though there's not ice in Las Vegas, never pull your goalie there. I just want to give that throw that information out to the listener. Never pull your goalie in Vegas.
Sounds like there's a story to back that up, Ren.
No, no. I just watched The Hangover recently.
Fair enough. And Fair enough. You don't have an itch that you can't explain. Okay. It's good to know.
Not today.
After the Usher concert that you went to in Vegas. It was...
Usher said, let it burn. Let it burn. And then he goes, how he said, gotta let it burn.
I love how we tainted.
And I just do what Usher says.
Story with that.
Yeah. That's how we do.
What don't we taint here? Yeah. If it is sweet, doth we not taint it?
So I sent this out as an email. I wasn't going to. Send it out as an email.
In the newsletter.
It will almost surely be an interlude in the next book. Because it really does reinforce a lot of the themes of that book. Like, that book is talking about a lot of the choices. It's talking about preparedness in your life choices. And so it really does reinforce a lot of the themes that I'm very grateful for, that I'm excited to share. And so I wrote that on Saturday morning, edited a few times over the course of Saturday, and then sent it off to my editor and my agent on Saturday, I don't know, afternoon, night. And then Monday morning, of course, I get an email from him at like 8:30 a.m. And he's just like, yep, received. And then at like 9:05 a.m., he sends me another email. He's like, next time you have to warn me when I'm going to start my week crying. So I think it's probably going to make it.
All the feels.
Yeah. I mean, people who... Look, like, everybody's got shit that they deal with. And I didn't talk about what was going on. I mean, first of all, because we didn't, you know, after so many miscarriages, we've kind of learned not to share when we're pregnant. Mm-hmm. But our family knew only because Allison was so sick. They wouldn't have known otherwise. But we've learned not to share it. But also, everybody's got shit that they deal with. Everybody's got something that they're going on. And so, I mean, sometimes times are easier, sometimes that they're harder. Anyway, so I decided to share this via email on Monday. And I got a lot of responses. Very nice responses. Actually, the first response that I got back was almost immediate. And it said, who the hell are you and why the hell are you emailing me? After that, they were very nice responses. And I said, so you subscribe to my newsletter, but I have deleted you now and forever forth in the future. But it's amazing when you open up with stuff like this, just how many people have dealt with something similar. Mm-hmm. And how little you hear about it. And so, you know, Allison and I have kind of decided to share it now in retrospect. I mean, she's still ill. She's out of bed for the most part, but like in bed still throughout the day. But Allison and I have decided to share it for no other reason than just like other people go through this. And I feel like there needs to be more of a conversation about it, that you're not alone. And also just, yo, there's only so much that you can do when shit already hits the fan. I mean, this is what we preach so much professionally in the health and fitness industry, isn't it? Like, mm-hmm. What would you prefer intellectually, to not get sick by taking care of your health and fitness in advance? Not really knowing whether the work that you're doing in the gym or eating good food or going for walks or whatever is actually going to make it so you don't get sick 20 years down the road. Like, you don't really know. And you still might get sick anyway. And then you'll say, well, fuck it. I wasted all that time, like, riding my bike or some shit. Like, that was stupid of me. You know, I still got cancer, which, of course, happens too, which is not fair. But if there's any way to skew the odds of that in my favor, then I'm going to take it. But a lot of what we do is we emphasize the reactive modalities, you know, how to make something better once it's already painful. Because once it's painful, it's present. Mm-hmm. And what I really wanted to do with this short piece of writing that kind of exploded out of me that I did not anticipate writing when I wrote it, I sat down to write something else for the book. And I was like, God, no, I got to write this. Like, I wrote that entire thing. It's, I don't know how long it is, like 1,400, 1,500 words. I think I wrote that in about 45 minutes. And it did not need much editing. That's just what happens, I feel like, when stuff bubbles up. And I was taking notes throughout. You know, like those dates were dates that I sat down and I was like, I'm just going to kind of chronicle this just because I feel like we're going to want to reflect back on it when this next child is born and not have it just be one of those like, oh, remember that time when you felt kind of sick? Like, mm-hmm. like actually remember what it was like to be grateful. And also to be grateful for a lot of the decisions and perhaps reinforce a lot of the decisions that we make that are hard decisions in the present that we worry about. Decisions like not enrolling Calvin in math tutoring, for example, or well, all of our neighbors do, right? I mean, we live in a reasonably wealthy neighborhood. Like everybody who has young kids, their kids are going to Kumon, Spirit of Mouth, all that shit. Decisions like maybe Amber, like you and me not working as hard as we could work on projects like Quick Coach, and it's there and it's fine. And it's serving people exceptionally well, extraordinarily well. But if you speak to anybody who's like a software as a SaaS business expert, they're like, what the hell are you doing? You have all those users and all that traction. And this is what you're doing with it. Like you could make so much more money. You could do so many more things. You should go get funding. You should go in. And it's like, no, this works for us and for the people who are using this. Mm-hmm. Decisions like that, because yes, one part of me says there are missed opportunities with Quick Coach, for example. It's just one example. Another part of me says, God damn, Amber, this last 2 months, I'm really happy that we did not have the pressures of aggressive growth mm-hmm. and investors, for example, bearing down our necks that we were responsible to. Yep. I mean, that might have broke me. Seriously.
Yeah.
Might have broke me.
I find that half of being an adult is reasoning out whether the juice is worth the squeeze or not.
That's what she said.
Looking back on a few decades of life, like, there's hyperbole around... this is going to be my best chance to XYZ. They come again. Yeah. Chances come again. Like,
isn't that interesting?
Can't get caught up in that shit. Yeah. Like,
you know, put a pin in that and highlight that.
Going,
like, this is my last opportunity. If this goes away, facing, I will fail.
Yes. Front facing your 20s and 30s, you really do feel like I'm not going to, everything's M&M, right? Everything's one shot. You might miss your chance to blow. Opportunity comes within a lifetime. And rear view mirroring that, total bullshit. Like, literally, the next week, I had the same opportunity. And I was like, oh, it's easier for me this week. I'll just do it.
Hey, Jonathan Goodman, and I wanted to invite you to pre-order my next book called The Obvious Choice. This is my first traditionally published book. It's been published by HarperCollins. Sam Poe, if you listen to My First Million podcast, called it a much-needed recalibration for a business generation that's focused on the wrong thing at the wrong time. Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, said that if you want to win in business without feeling like you need to win the internet, you gotta get this book. So why pre-order it instead of getting it when it's ready? Well, there's two reasons, really. The first is that it's really, really beneficial for me, selfishly. It helps me a lot. My publishers love it. But the second beneficial for you is you actually lock in the best ever price. No joke, I pre-ordered a book that was $40 not too long ago. And because the price went down over the pre-order period for like a day to $29.99, when the book arrived to me on the day of the launch, I actually got refunded by Amazon $10. Because when you pre-order a book on Amazon, you lock in the lowest price ever. So if Amazon ever lowers the price, which they often do, you're gonna get that price and get refunded, whatever the difference is from when you pre-ordered it. So there's benefit to you, there's benefit to me. Please pre-order the book, The Obvious Choice, anywhere you buy books, but Amazon gives you this other benefit. Hope that you love it. Hope you're good.
But this week, Like, there's not a lot of chasmoclitic choices that you're going to make.
Which is dangerous, though, right? I mean, on one hand...
It can be.
I agree with you, which is a wonderful way to live your life, to say, hey, yo, whatever is going on right now that I think is such a big deal is actually probably not that big of a deal, and I'm going to look back on it and, like, hardly remember it, and even if I do remember it, be like, remember that time when?
Right.
But, on the other hand, I don't think that that is an excuse to coast. I mean, the books that I'm writing now, I've got The Obvious Choice coming out in 2.5 months. Y'all, I am being aggressive. Mm-hmm. Because it deserves it. Because it deserves it. I put so much work and effort into that thing. Wrote the shit out of it. It's a phenomenal book. I think it's one of the best books ever written in the world on subjects like that. I might be proven by the market to be wrong. You know? But I'm going to do my damnedest to give it an opportunity to have a chance. And if I'm proven that I'm wrong, and the market does not respond in the way that I hope that it will, but it might not, honestly, then I'm already 3/4 done the next damn book.
Yep.
And it's going to be the same thing. It does not give an excuse, though, to coast with what you're doing.
Right.
I think whatever you're doing needs to be the most important thing that you're doing right then, and you should do the hell out of it. But I think you also, once that's done, I think you also can't sit there and bitch and moan if it perhaps doesn't get the response that you hope that it would get in the market. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You give it the best opportunity possible. You don't stop talking about it just because something is out. You're like, yo, once The Obvious Choice comes out, like, I've been marketing this book now already for 6 months. It's 2.5 months out. I've been writing it and planning it for 3 years. Once the book comes out on January 14th, I figure I'm probably about 10% of the way there.
Right.
I mean, you have to continue, right, pushing this thing, marketing this thing. A lot of the marketing that we're doing now is setting the seeds for things that will be ongoing for years to come. But of course, projects, any project, coaching is even more of this. Like coaching and doing a great job with clients and building a personal brand compounds better than books. If done right, not worse. And so if you think this doesn't apply to you, you're making up shit in your own head and get your foot out of your ass. It does, whatever you do.
People don't like the long haul, John. It's uncomfortable in an instant, I'll use a Southern term, in an instant grits society. Nobody likes to make the grits from scratch. It's too cumbersome. But when I get the opportunity to talk to coaches in the Online Trainer Academy, they talk to me about the day, and I talk to them about their life from adolescence. Right? They say, "Well, you know, I can't find anybody to talk to." I was like, "Were you shitty to people in high school? Did you speak to people?" It's probably going to be your base for your business and what you're feeling now, with feeling like nobody's liking your stuff, nobody's connecting with you, nobody's listening. Probably because you didn't like anybody's stuff 20 years ago when you were like 15 years old, and you didn't listen to anybody, you didn't like it. It's a long haul thing. Mm-hmm. And the way you balance that, I'm gonna give you guys some sage wisdom, dear listener, vegans in California who are probably on their third latte and in between getting on the reformer and doing your aerial gymnastics at the aerial place right now on your way there.
Eating $18 falafels and hummus just after your jiu-jitsu session.
You
went for a walk with your third girlfriend.
You got some hummus on your Lululemon, and you need to put the top up on the cabriolet because it's going to rain in California later today. What are we at now?
Polyamorous jiu-jitsu ice bath breath work $18 falafel vegans.
Ice bath.
Lululemon, Volkswagen cabriolet driver with drop tops.
We need to turn this into a shirt. What's crazy is that
it's not wrong.
it's all the same person.
It's all the same person.
The person who does one is the same person who does all of them. They also have blue blocker sunglasses that they wear at night to be able to block the light, of course, to be able to
blue light from the screen because you got to go to sleep.
And then they just fucking binge Andrew Huberman podcasts.
Pretty much.
I mean, it's the same person, Dave. Dave, it's you. You do all these things.
What are you doing?
If you do one of these things, you do all these things. I don't think it's possible to be polyamorous and not do jujitsu. I really just don't think that that is a possibility. And if that's you, I really don't think it's possible to not post a picture of you in an ice bath on social media.
Pretty much. Pretty much.
It's habit stacking. James Clear. There you go.
That's exactly what it is. What are you doing for the next 6 hours? The next 6 hours, I'm going to listen to 1.5 Huberman podcasts. So what I was about to say is the way you balance that is urgency in the micro and patience in the macro, right? The day for me, I like goals for the day, but I like intentions for the period of life, right? Because it allows you to be urgent in the day that you're in. I write at least three urgent things every day that I need to get accomplished. And that keeps me from coasting, but having an intention overall instead of a goal allows me to be present. So I don't feel like it's cataclysmic if something doesn't work out the way that I want. A goal of contacting 10 people today, an intention of being social and engaging on social networks. So the goal defines the day, the intention defines the existence. And I always use coupling, marriage and relationships, because having a goal to get married can be sort of frustrating. Every day up to that, you're not married. And every day after that, it can get to like, what now? But having intention of being a loving, supportive partner, you could do that on date two. You can open the door and be nice and throw your coat down over a puddle. We still do that in the South.
Are you a loving and supportive partner to somebody right now?
Yes, John, to both of my partners on this podcast right now. I'm being loving and supportive.
One day you will let one thing slip about your personal life. And that's the day when we shut down this podcast and never record again.
It's the last episode. That'll be the series finale of The Obvious Choice. Tonight on the series finale of Obvious Choice.
When finally tells us the name of his significant other.
Pat. So
John walks away into the sunset and never produces content ever again.
John walks away with his 15 children, never to produce content.
It's like that Seinfeld episode. It's like, you really think, Jerry, that this couple settled in this neighborhood 50 years ago and started a dry cleaner and service this neighborhood for 50 years just so that they could shut down and run away with your old running shoes? Like, you really think that you wrote and self-published 11 books and 1,500 articles and close to 1,000 podcast episodes?
Thinking ahead.
Over the course of 14 years and counting, just so you could find out the name of Ren's significant other.
It's the long play.
and get a job like as a contractor
The sheer pathology of that long-term scam. This is Ocean's 11 level scam.
But you can't not respect it, right?
You cannot. It's a hustle that has to be respected. That's a good passage, John. And I didn't know. I was today years old when I found out that a book could have an interlude. I know all about them from CDs common. From the 90s.
You know why I kind of thought about this? It's interesting because I've spoken to a few other people that love reading as much as I do, and they all do the same thing. When I get a book, the first page that I open is the acknowledgments. Because I thought about why, and it gives me an insight into who the author really is. You know, obviously the names of the people they name mean nothing to me, but it gives me an insight into who the author really is. It's their voice. It's them writing. And then oftentimes what happens is the acknowledgments are kind of just like a throwaway, like, hey, you know, it's it's my name on the front of the book, but writing is not a solitary endeavor. And so here's the other people that helped me make this book. And it's like, yeah, this book is going to suck. Like, basically, is what that means. or sometimes what happens, of course, is that you read that, and it's in this, like, beautiful voice, and you're like, oh, I really like this person. And then you read the book, and they're just like, I don't know, boring nonfiction. Like, and then trash. This research paper says whatever. And you're like, come on, man, you had it. Like, why are you why is it that the minute your phalanges hit those keys, all of a sudden you turn into a robot? Clearly, that's not who you are. Phalange those keys. Well, and so I find that it really. So number one is I actually put a lot of effort into the acknowledgments and into the dedication sections. I find that those details really are special when they are special, not just to the people mentioned in them, but me reading those so many times and. I appreciate it a lot when an author has something like I feel like you can actually learn a lot in a good acknowledgement section, mm-hmm. As well. And I hope you do in the one that I wrote as well. But in doing that, of course, it's one of those weird things where, you start to realize just how many people you know. I get asked all the time, as I'm sure you do, Wen and Amber, you're saying that the best way to get customers is to actually talk to a human. I don't have anybody to talk to. Who do I talk to? It's like, really?
Hey, bro, what are you doing?
That's a sad state if that's true. But it's not true. Everybody has a list. And so a lot of what I try to do is just like, couple days a week, I'll just go out and just try to celebrate something else somebody does. It's not organized. I don't have a framework around it. It's just, I'll see people that I'm following, maybe people I know, maybe people I don't know. Everybody's talking about the stuff that they're proud of and getting almost no response back to it.
Right. Right.
On social media. The same as you.
Right.
Right. Just that person, like, buy their book. And take a screenshot of the pre-order page, like whatever, of the purchase page, and tag them in it and say that this was an Insta buy because of how much you value this person. You didn't even read what the book was about. You know that it's going to be great. Man. You have made that person's month.
Whoever it is. Like, whoever it doesn't even matter who it is. I've punched above my weight class in this business so much. By just considering telling a person that I respect something that they did or I liked something that they said. Right. The last conference we went to, John, in Edmonton, Evolve, I talked to Lee Boyce for an hour in the lobby because I just said, hey, Lee, that was a really interesting topic that you talked about the other day. Mm. Can you tell me a little bit more about it if you have time? And he just stood there and talked to me for an hour because – I guess kind of nobody does that. People will ask him for information, but to say, hey, you know, you did a thing and I noticed it and I think it was pretty awesome that you did it. And he was like taken aback. Like, and this nobody ever takes time.
This doesn't have to be anybody like in any way influential in your industry, of course.
Just any human.
Anybody. I mean, people, like, I know a guy who I was a counselor at a summer camp with way back when, that is now a real estate agent in LA. And like, he posts about houses that he has listed that go up for sale.
Right.
I'll comment words of support on that.
Yep.
Another guy I lost touch with, I used to be friends with him, you know, back in high school. We lost touch, but we were still Facebook friends. And he's like some coding genius, apparently. I don't really know. I don't understand those things. Ones mm-hmm. and zeros, whatever. GitHub, you know, that's about all that I know. But he just got a new job. And so I congratulated him on it. And he sent me a message and we like caught up a bit. And, you know, he had noticed the stuff that I was doing because I was talking about it. He never messaged me on it, right? But that's somebody to talk to, is all that I'm saying. Just yes. support people in the thing that they care about is the easiest way to find people to talk to today.
Super easy.
It's really that simple. It's really that simple. Anyway, I don't know. Anything else you guys want to talk about? I think we're good.
It's a good show, John. I like your interlude. It was the first interlude I've ever had read to me.
Oh, so that's why I was gonna that's where the acknowledge. I was trying to figure out why I started talking about the acknowledgements because I lost my train of thought, and then I was able to.
We don't know, John.
Bring it back in a way that maybe made sense, maybe didn't make sense.
I didn't know you had a train of thought. To be perfectly honest with you, I just sits down and randomly says things.
I do. Right. Because you got to take up space. Sell me this pen. Or what was a famous story? Mike Rowe, the Dirty Jobs guy, talked about his interview for QVC for the shopping network. And they sat down and it was an interview with him. And they said, for the next 20 minutes, I want you to talk to me about this pencil. And you'd get the job if you could talk for 20 minutes about that pencil.
Amber just had a new nightmare unlocked.
And but actually that's a pretty interesting skill to develop. And so that's what you kind of have to do here in between stuff. So the interlude, going back to the interlude. Interludes are not common in books but one of the things that I have seen from time to time that I really do find helps me build a connection with the author and make the material in the book more real is when the author reflects on what's going on in their personal life as they're writing the book, as it pertains to the book. A lot of books are written as retrospectives. A lot of books are written actually as aspirational books for the author. You know, it's things the author kind of wishes about themselves, but maybe not have done, or they've read other people do, and they're kind of reporting on it, which is totally fine. I just don't like that as much personally, and I certainly don't want to write that. Instead, what I want to do is try to reflect on the things that I've done that have helped me. Try to reflect on the things that perhaps I haven't done or I do differently that have not served me and report on that. And when this happened, once I caught my breath, of course, when I was writing that email to him and then the VP at HarperCollins, my agent, there were a few people on it. I was like, but actually, this is a really good test to see whether what I'm writing in this book is complete and utter fucking bullshit or not. And I don't know what the answer is because I have never been tested this much before. It's not just how much I had to take on. It was the unknown. I had no idea how long it was going to go for. Could have been 8 months. It's still kind of going. Could have been 8 months. There could have been massive loss involved too. At that point, we were still at risk very seriously for a miscarriage. And I mean, that would have been it. Like this is the last pregnancy. There's no way that Allison's body really can go. I mean, the woman has gone through 10 pregnancies that we know of. You think about what that does to a woman's body with the hormones up and down. And so I told her, of course, I'm like, oh, that's cool. We can adopt the next. She laughed.
She should have.
She laughed. But this was going to be the last one. And so we both had to, at the same time, mentally prepare for a loss, for the loss, for the last loss. That was hanging over our heads. And so there's another book that I'm thinking of. Stephen King wrote a book called On Writing, and it's a great book to learn how to write. Stephen King obviously has sold a lot of books. Obviously, can write well. You know, it's fiction, but the best way to write anything is to become a great storyteller, to become a great fiction writer. Mm-hmm. Like the reason why most nonfiction books are fucking utter shit is because all that most nonfiction writers read is fiction. That's why. Nonfiction books have to read like fiction, or else they are hideously boring and unimpactful. I mean, 85 to 90% of my reading these days is fiction. not nonfiction anymore. And so this book by Stephen King on writing, you know, it was a very good book and it would have been a very good book. But here's what happened midway through. He was writing it and he got hit by a car and he almost died. He got hit by a drunk driver and he almost died. And she couldn't write. I mean, he thought for a long time that he was never going to write again. And he ended up, of course, being able to write again and finishing the book. And he tells that story at the end of it. And that story of how he had to basically relearn how to move his body. And also this discipline that had been so habitual for him for his entire career. This guy, every single day, would write 2,000 words. Right? I can't remember. I get people confused whether he finished at 11 a.m. every day or he wrote two. I think he was the guy who wrote 2,000 words every single day, no matter how long it took. And if he finished by 9 a.m., he was done at 9 a.m. If it took him till 4 p.m., he wrote till 4 p.m. I think he might have been that guy. Who knows if that's a real story or not or whatever. But the point is, exceptionally disciplined. Write 7 days a week. No days off. Because to him, it's a habit. Well, he couldn't write for a year, year and a half. And he had to pick it back up. And so to be able to tell that story of like, literally, life hit him. Like, I mean, in that passage I read at the beginning, you know, you can jump in the car and go for a ride, or you can let the car hit you on the way past. Like, he got hit by that car. Mm-hmm. Literally, he got hit by that car. Yeah. And that makes what he was writing about so much more real and important. And so you could never fabricate it. So that's why I think you don't see a lot of interludes, because to me, an interlude is like, what has happened while the author was writing this book that really puts a star on the book of like, this is real life shit. Like, this is how things are.
Kind of like breaking the fourth wall. Like,
so I think it'll be an interlude.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think to be honest, I mean, it is the fourth wall. I think this interlude will probably go right in the part of the book that I'm at writing right now. Like, this interlude will go between chapters 5 and 6. I think. But we'll see. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.